mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine a world without work, where machines take over for humans and slog through menial, messy work without complaint, leaving people free to do whatever they choose, play music or make their own food or furniture or write stories or teach anything instead of what they have to do. Sounds like a version of utopia or a setup for a science fiction story. But given the number of jobs now being automated, that leisurely future may be coming sooner than you think. In celebration of Labor Day, we're exploring the nature of work, of office jobs and vacations and more. And we're starting with Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic. Earlier this year, he wrote about what a post-job society might look like and how we might get ready for a world without work. Well, this is a long story of human progress being marked by creating machines, replacing human toil. So where are we in that progression now?
This is a process that's been going on probably since the first time a caveman fashioned a handsaw. That was maybe, you know, the first element of technology that saved them some amount of time. But, you know, the modern economy today is the outcome of lots of technological growth. We were an agrarian economy, and then technology moved us off the farms into factories, and technology moved us out of the factories into a service economy. And the thought here is that we're beginning to automate a lot of the jobs that are currently the bread and butter of that service economy. The prediction that technology would replace a lot of workers is, you know, as old as the Luddites. John Maynard Keynes thought that within 100 years, by 2030, we would have a 15-hour work week. So I try to say, you know, at the top of the piece, this is not an original vision. What I try to do is to put a little bit of psychological meat on the bones and say, all right, well, what do we really think this world would be like? What would it be like in terms of what we do? And in terms of how we feel about what we do, do we really need to work to be happy?
Well, so one of the things you did is go to Youngstown, Ohio. This is a city hit very hard by the end of manufacturing. How have people there coped with losing work?
Youngstown was visited by what economists call a regional depression. The steel mills shut down in the late 1970s, sort of wiping out the central pillar of that city's economy. And in the last 3.5 decades, it has struggled to regain a sense of itself, both economically and in terms of its own pride. And so I went there to look at, you know, what is a community that has faced the closest thing we can find to the end of work? How has that community coped? And what I found was really interesting. On the one hand, there are obvious signs of sadness. There is poverty. There are people who are still leaving the city. And even though the city and some of the main downtown areas are going through a small kind of rejuvenation, there are an enormous number of people, particularly young people, who are excited to leave and not to stay. On the other hand, there are people who have stayed who I think have dealt with this reality with a sense of resilience. And I was really interested to see how their sense of pride had evolved to deal with their reality. So, for example, when most people go to a party and somebody asks them, what do you do? You say, I do one thing. I'm a radio host. I'm a writer. I work in marketing. In Youngstown, the full-time economy has evaporated a little bit. And as a result, there are lots of people doing many different things. They're bartending, working as a cashier, writing poems, writing music, farming in a lot by their home. And so they often seem to draw a sense of satisfaction from their resourcefulness.
And in Youngstown, they got to this after some years of difficulty where people, the mental health issues spiked, spousal abuse, addiction. People talked about watching TV or sleeping. But I guess they got to the other side of this. And you introduced this concept of the post-workist life. Is that what it means, getting to the place of resourcefulness over just sitting around, you know, missing what was?
Well, on the one hand, there are cities like Youngstown that I think should make us extremely cautious about, quote, rooting, end quote, for this post-work world, because it seems like in the current economy, when people lose their job, they are miserable. In fact, there are studies that suggest that long-term unemployment is a trauma that is even harder to recover from perhaps the loss of a loved one, because one of the things that helps people deal with emotional traumas is a sense of purpose and a sense sense of routine. And these are the things that a job gives. And so when you don't have a job, you don't have these sort of alleviative measures. That said, there are people, as you mentioned, who have been called the post-workists, who are extremely imaginative and creative about thinking, you know, how can we welcome the automation of the U.S. economy and use it to better sort of human life? There was a great quote from someone who I talked to who said, you know, the word school comes from a Greek word skol, which means leisure. He said, we used to teach people to be free, and now we teach people to work. And so he sees a future where you have more automation, software, machines, robots, whatever you'd like to call them, doing the most common occupations, cashier, retail salesperson, office admin, food and beverage worker. More of these jobs are done by machines, and more people can focus on human flourishing because there are too many jobs, they rightly point out, these post-workists, there are too many jobs that are just a paycheck, that offer none of the benefits of positive psychology. The autonomy, the independence, the ability to develop mastery, the sense of purpose or even transcendence that people can find in jobs they truly love. A lot of the most common jobs don't offer that very readily. Mm-hmm. And so we should hope for ways that we can nudge people toward jobs that can offer these things more available.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how they do that. I mean, right now, American culture is work-centric. Jobs are identities. Productivity is self-worth. It motivates us. It's a sign of status. It gives people meaning. Are these just habits or ways of thinking that can be changed?
So a great way that this question was posed to me by a post-workist named Peter Frace, he said, you know, a job is essentially three things. It's the production of the world, it's the earning of income, and it's that third thing, purpose or meaning. Right now, all these things are wrapped up together. You need people to make the world work. We have income that goes to people who work, and sometimes those jobs have meaning, and then sometimes they don't. But imagine a world, these people say, imagine a world where income wasn't so closely tied to work, because so much of what we call work right now is being done by machines. So imagine we had something called a universal basic income. That is, the government sends a check of a certain amount every single month to every single person, whether or not they are attached to the labor market. This is essentially like Social Security for everybody, and it would come presumably from a tax on capital, a tax on the top 1% or even a smaller share. What this measure would do is, A, it would give people a certain amount of economic dignity no matter what, and which seems important, particularly in a world where these working opportunities are dissipating. But second, it can allow people to reject the worst jobs, allow those worst jobs to be automated so that they can focus on things that are more meaningful. You know, there are a lot of incredibly essential jobs like caring for children, caring for the elderly, donating time to community service that are compensated with $0 or very little money. And it seems to me not entirely a dystopian future to imagine that if more jobs today were being done by machines, we could spend more time with each other. We could spend more time with our families and with our communities, and that there are all sorts of benefits that could come from that.
We're speaking with Derek Thompson, whose cover story for The Atlantic envisions a world, ideal or not, without work. Well, in this thought experiment, that's a pretty radical idea, especially now, you know, given our political climate, having the will to tax the top earners or to spread it around in a much more, dare I say, redistributed way. But there's also a lot of things that change, you know, even the landscape of the country, even the family structure. How does this evolve in the post-work world?
The geography of the United States right now, in many ways, is dictated by capitalism, by an economy that concentrates jobs in downtowns and certain suburban areas, and people go to move near to those jobs, and the highway system and our housing policy is very much rooted around creating clusters of work and then clusters of residential areas in order for those people to get to work. And so there's all sorts of, you know, incredibly bold and imaginative ways ways that we could reshape the geography of the country if we didn't have to commute to downtown areas in order to work, or at least if commuting was abated in some way. And so I think that there's other ways in which this vision of a world without work can be radical and even a little bit scary. So perhaps one of the most scary outcomes sort of voiced to me was this idea that you think about education in the United States. Most people go to high school, finish high school, go to college. Increasingly, the millennial generation has the highest rate of education attainment of any generation in the U.S. But we're completing these years of school in order to develop discipline and skills for the workforce. What happens when the expectation that a workforce is waiting for us at the end of this conveyor belt of education, what happens when that expectation goes away? Will fewer people go to school? Will fewer parents feel a necessity for their children to spend all this time learning this information and these skills? That's a kind of a scary thought, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, we're going to be, even if the modern form of capitalism changes over the next few decades, we're still going to be a democracy. And we have a tremendous interest in an educated citizenry. And it's possible that, you know, the interest in educated citizenry could outlive the need for a vastly skilled workforce. And that's a scary possibility to even you sort of wrap your head around. And so, you know, even though I try to invoke all sorts of elements of positive psychology to imagine how we can nudge people through this shift towards better jobs that'll make them happy, that'll allow them to spend more time with their family, there are all sorts of ways that this disruption could be truly dystopian.
Now, we do today have examples of people who give up high-pressure jobs to pursue their true calling, you know, to do their passion work. But it assumes the ability to make that choice. I'm thinking about the lower rungs, the working class members of society that have been left behind by the shift in manufacturing, shifts in working class jobs. What happens to income disparity under this model?
Income disparity under this model would almost certainly get worse. There's really no way around that. The question is, the flip side is, would the mechanization, would the automation of a lot of these industries make goods so cheap that even though some people wouldn't be earning a lot of income, they could still live lives that by sort of modern comparison might seem luxurious or certainly free of certain needs. So if you had people, if you had, you know, machines taking over transportation and you had an abundance of housing because you wouldn't need all of that office space, you know, one can imagine an economy in which things were incredibly available and cheap to lots of people and that's certainly something to root for. But, you know, that shouldn't be totally teased apart from the fact that, you know, technological change, you know, visited on the lower class often has incredibly negative income, certainly when it comes to what's happened with manufacturing, which used to be this incredibly powerful means of distributing income to the middle class, and now is only, I think, as a share of the economy, a third of what it was in the 1950s, 1960s. So it's true, I think, that, you know, both the technologists and the sort of labor liberals, I think, both have a case here. That on the one hand, there's obvious evidence that things are getting better and cheaper, and we are able to get services and products to people that we never could have imagined doing 50 years ago. But at the same time, there is a class of Americans that are falling behind in terms of real income, and that hurts their ability to afford things today that aren't getting cheaper, like healthcare and housing and childcare.
Listening to you speak, you really thought this through, clearly, Derek. I mean, do you envision it for yourself? Can you imagine living in this post-work society and what that would mean for you?
I can imagine the transition. I can imagine living through a period when the expectation to work full-time begins to dissipate. You know, right now, part-time work in America, freelance work in America, is sort of like that old line about computers. I think an economist once said, computers are everywhere in the economy except in the statistics. Hmm. And that's sort of, I think, what we're seeing now with sort of the part-time freelance work, is that on the one hand, we have all this anecdotal evidence that the Ubers and Airbnbs and TaskRabbits of the world are taking over, but it's not quite yet obvious in the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, data. I think that it's possible that in the next recession and the recession after that, we see elevated part-time work, part-time work grow during those recessions and not fall a lot during the subsequent recoveries, so that an expectation among young people that a lot of their life is going to be lived, sort of piecing together jobs, might be a reality, might become a norm. There's a hyperbolic way of saying this, which is that my grandfather had one job in his entire life. My father had six jobs in his life. I will have six jobs at one time in my life, sort of Moore's Law visited upon the labor force and job sharing. I think that that's probably a little audacious, but something like that could happen, and I can imagine it. I can imagine it happening. And on the one hand, I'm ambivalent, both here, speaking into the mic and in the piece, about whether this is a good or a bad thing. I think lots of jobs are terrible, but I think work is important. And I think that it's important that we find ways to connect people to jobs that are meaningful to them.
But freelancers juggling six jobs, a lot of them, we have this idea that they're sitting around in their pajamas, but people are working really hard to line up the next job. Is there really more leisure time in the freelance life?
This is a really interesting question. So on the one hand, there's some evidence in the data that there's something called leisure inequality, which suggests actually that it's the richest workers in the economy, the top 10%, who are working more than they used to, and sort of the bottom 60% in particular, who are struggling to find full-time work because their jobs are in retail, where often the work week isn't 50 hours a week, it's more like 30, 35. So on the one hand, there's some evidence that suggests that it is lower-income people who have less leisure right now. On the other hand, there's a growth of single mothers in America, and being a single mom while trying to work and support your kids probably affords you the least leisure of any sort of job and family situation I can imagine. So once again, it's a complicated picture, and it's my fear in terms of the leisure picture is that when people lose their jobs right now, particularly men, they spend a lot of time on the couch watching TV, browsing the internet, and sleeping. They don't spend a lot of time socializing or trying to look for work. And there's all sorts of reasons for this, partly economic, they can't afford to spend time out of the apartment or the house potentially, and also maybe shame and lack of dignity. They're upset that they can't hang out with their friends and talk about their workday. So it's complicated, but right now a lot of people seem to deal with the lack of work through a growth in leisure. And there's all sorts of studies that suggest that too much leisure simply saps us of dignity. Idleness makes us feel really bad about ourselves, even though we want idleness. It's something that I call in the piece the paradox of leisure, that watching TV, watching Netflix is something we want to do in the present because it feels like contentment. But something more than contentment, pride, and meaning always comes from the reflection on past accomplishments. And so, even though I envision a future in which fewer people can expect to have full-time work, I want them to have pride and to have purpose in their lives. And I don't see a future of leisure as being a superior replacement for the economy we have now.
Derek, thank you so much. So much to think about.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson, he's a writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. You can find a link to read his article, A World Without Work, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.